This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. School districts around the country are considering starting the school day later at middle and high school levels. That's because research shows that there are major health and educational benefits when teens get more sleep. Later, we'll talk to one of the leading researchers on school start times about the health and educational benefits of pushing back when that first bell rings. First, we're looking at start times in a Wisconsin school district and disruptions that have happened not because of sleep, but because of bus schedules. Our first guest is a local reporter who's been covering a mid-semester change to start and dismissal times in the Madison Metropolitan School District. The story is just one example in a wider context, but it illustrates some of the challenges to changing schedules at schools. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How do school start and dismissal times affect you as a parent, a teacher, a student? If you remember your teen years, did school start too early? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Scott Girard is the K-12 education reporter at the Cap Times. Scott, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you very much for having me.
Give us some background leading into this 2023-24 school year. What led to an effort to change start times for some schools?
Yeah, it really starts about 7 years ago. The district began exploring some of what you were talking about, the research on later start times benefiting especially older students like middle schoolers. After a couple years of research and community outreach, they had settled on a plan in 2018 to move middle school start times later. And so they began implementing that in fall 2019. Of course, later that school year, COVID-19 hit and disrupted everything around education, including implementation of that plan in the coming years. And so even once school returned in person in 2021 here in Madison, they weren't able to implement the plan as had been outlined. But this year, they had the opportunity to start a new bus contract and decided to continue implementation of that plan and move middle school start times later. So they began the year with that in place and what's called a two-tier busing start time schedule. And that led to quite a few busing issues and ultimately the decision a couple weeks ago to change start and dismissal times mid-year.
Yeah, a lot of districts around the state are struggling with what's at least part of the problem, what went wrong in Madison. Not enough school bus drivers. So fall school starts, what happens with this new bus plan?
Yeah, on a daily basis, buses were as much as an hour late in the morning or afternoons, and it just wasn't getting better. So it was something with a new bus company in place. There were some anticipated hiccups at the beginning of the year. And from parents I talked to, they were willing to accept some of that as the year began. But as it continued, even a month and a half into the school year, with really no solution in sight, it became clear the problem wasn't just going to get better with time. There was a serious problem with just not enough drivers to staff the routes. And those drivers weren't going to magically appear overnight.
So changing school start times, you know, on a plan with a lot of lead time, that can be a logistical challenge and it requires a lot of adjustments for people. Now you're talking about changing mid first semester of the school year. Talk about how that shook out.
Yeah, so the district announced it in mid to late October that it would be effective November 6th. Of course, the first day after daylight savings time changes as well. So I know a lot of parents were already having students adjust to sleep schedules, but they had about 2 weeks lead time. And for two elementary schools specifically saw the biggest changes. They moved back actually 50 minutes. So nearly an hour, they started later than they had been when the year began. Another about 21 elementary schools moved 5 minutes earlier on start and dismissal time, so a pretty small change. And then a few middle schools also moved back 20 minutes. And the big concern with that wasn't necessarily the fact that they moved 20 minutes. It was that moving 20 minutes meant they weren't going to get dismissed until 4:30 now. And with the time change and obviously winter ahead, that means that sometimes students will be leaving in the dark already, middle school students. And so that has concerned some parents as well.
Yeah, 50 minutes even may not sound like a lot, but you talk to some teachers and parents who had kind of made plans for how this school year was going to work. What did you hear from them?
Yeah, you know, families settle into routines, and I think that's something parents and teachers stress to me is for children especially, those routines can be really important to sort of settle them in, and they know how the day is going to operate so they can focus in on the things they're at school to do. And when you disrupt that by almost an hour, not only can it disrupt those sorts of things, but logistically, students are signed up for, you know, swim lessons or what have you, other sports, therapy sessions. There's a lot of different appointments that are made based on school schedules, including parents' work schedules. A lot of times parents will work those out so they could drop their student off or see them off on the bus and be home in time to get them off the bus. And an hour difference, depending on your job, might just not be doable. So there's been some parents who have continued to drop their student off at the same time they were before because they don't have an option. And that just means that student is waiting outside the school longer. And as winter approaches, you know, that's especially concerning. And I also heard from some teachers who have children themselves in schools. And previously, maybe the school schedule worked out that they were going to be able to drop their kid off or pick them up conveniently around their own school schedule. And that suddenly became not true. And they were having to figure that out.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Rich is with us in Green Bay. Rich, hi.
Hello. A few years ago, like 2019, Green Bay Public Schools took a good look at this issue. And it looks like they were going to move to later start times. But for a lot of reasons, it just hasn't happened. But one simple idea that I think would be helpful, it was just to eliminate daylight savings time. A few years ago, the United States Senate actually voted to eliminate daylight savings time, but nothing happened after they did that. But Wisconsin, because we border a time zone, it'd be pretty easy for Wisconsin just to say, we're not going to do daylight savings time.
Rich, I got you, Rich. Thanks for the call. I think that change is above our pay grade, Scott. But Rich points to Green Bay was on a similar path as Madison, it sounded like, starting in 2019. Here comes COVID. This could be a very long process to turn the ship of school start times.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's not something generally districts want to spring on people. They want, you know, as I was talking about, there's a lot of planning that families do around school schedules. So schools really want to let parents have the time to figure out what it's going to mean for their out-of-school lives to change those times. And this was just a situation where district officials have said they didn't have any other options. Otherwise, buses were going to continue to be an hour or more late, and that meant students missing instruction, and that was in a lack of predictability for families. So they decided that the headache of doing it sort of last minute was better than continuing the situation as it was unfolding.
And Scott, as we wrap up, this change just happened, I think, a week ago or so. I know it's still early, but are things running better now?
So according to some data the district got from the bus company and shared with me at the end of last week, it did look like on-time buses, the measure they use, which is within 10 minutes of the scheduled time, were increasing. So you could say it's better in that way. It still wasn't 100%. You know, I certainly, after that article published, heard from some folks who said, well, my student, that certainly wasn't true for my student. And so it's still not perfect. And so they're still working out some kinks in the system. And, you know, drivers are learning new routes now and tripling up on routes instead of doubling up on routes. So there's still definitely some things to be worked out. But that initial week data did show at least some improvement.
Scott, thanks again for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
That's Scott Girard, K-12 education reporter at the Cap Times, with us for a look on the latest reporting on the Madison Metropolitan School District's change to start and dismissal times at 27 schools last week after some bus logistical problems. Coming up, a researcher who's been following the issue of school start times will tell us how later start times can affect educational outcomes and sleep patterns and health, especially for teens. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How would it affect your family if school start times were pushed back? Do you live in a district that's already done this? What's your experience been like? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk about school start times now with one of the leading researchers on adolescent sleep health and education policy. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Should school start later, especially at the middle and high school levels? How would that affect your family, your school? Join in at 800-642-1234. Lisa Meltzer is a pediatric psychologist and professor at National Jewish Health. She's also the founder of Nyxios Consulting, which provides pediatric sleep solutions for researchers and clinical providers. Lisa, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Before we get into the sleep, Lisa, we just heard about some of the logistical challenges. We change school start times. If a district is saying, yes, we want to let kids sleep in a little bit later, what kind of plans do they have to make sure a change goes smoothly?
There are a number of logistical issues with changing start times, but they're all achievable. And so I think that's an important message. Mm-hmm. It changes hard and it feels very daunting. But the issue described here with the school bus drivers is something that a lot of districts have encountered because there's a national shortage on bus drivers. But that's not necessarily the same issue as later start times. Healthy start times, which is at least 8:30 for middle and high school students, are essential to allow students the opportunity to get enough sleep, which helps them with their academic functioning and their overall health and development.
Let's talk about those teenagers, tweens and teens, I think, and their sleep needs. Why is it that they, in particular, could benefit from starting a little bit later?
When adolescents go through puberty, hormones change. And one of those hormones that changes is melatonin. And melatonin is a naturally produced hormone that helps our body to recognize when it's time for going to sleep and when it's time for waking up. And in adolescence, again, going through puberty, the timing of that melatonin gets delayed by about 1 to 2 hours. So even adolescents who would try to go to sleep early, it's very hard for them to fall asleep because their body has physiologically changed. And so by having that trouble of going to sleep early and then on the flip side being awakened very early for an early school start time means that they're not getting enough sleep. And across the country and in my own research, when we have delayed start times for middle and high school students, what we find is that they don't actually end up staying up that much later, but they do sleep significantly later in the morning, on average about 30 to 40 minutes for middle school students and almost up to an hour for high school students, depending on how long the delay is. And that doesn't sound like a lot, but over the course of a school week, I mean, you're looking at somewhere between 2.5 to 4 extra hours of sleep per week, and then you multiply that by all the weeks of the school year, and now you have adolescents who are no longer sleep deprived.
I think this is a huge point, Lisa, because I think a lot of times people look at this situation and say, oh, teens are sleeping in because they're lazy. They're staying up late because they're making bad teenage decisions. This is biology we're talking about, it sounds like.
Correct. This is a physiological, biological change. And it's, I mean, there are other reasons why adolescents stay up. Sure, they've too many extracurricular activities and a lot of homework. And there's always, we can blame technology and social media, but all of these issues have been acknowledged and recognized for over 40 years, long before we all had our phones and technology in the bedrooms. It is a biological issue.
Now, you've mentioned, you've hinted at some of the benefits here. You did, I understand, a 5-year study in Colorado on changing start times and impact on sleep. Can you dig into some of the details? What did you find over the course of that big project?
Sure. So one of our suburban districts here in the Denver metro area with 55,000 students covering a range of 104 square miles. And I mentioned that because of the transportation issues and how long it takes some of the kids to get to school. But they delayed high school start times from 7:10 to 8:20, and they delayed middle school start times from 8 to 8:45. And they moved elementary school start times earlier from 9 to 8. And what we found over the 3 years of data that we collected, plus focus groups and teachers, is that students, as I said, in middle school and high schools didn't go to bed later, but they slept later and they got more sleep. And in our nation, about 25% of adolescents are getting sufficient sleep duration. And by changing school start times in our district, we now had about 65% of adolescents getting enough sleep. So just that one change made a huge difference. But what we also found were changes to attendance and how engaged students were. Teachers got more sleep. Parents of middle school and high school students got more sleep. Students in elementary school who started an hour earlier, their actual sleep duration didn't change that much. So those are younger children who haven't gone through the biological changes and can wake up slightly earlier for those earlier start times. And in our focus groups, we found lots of positive benefits that aren't always tangible, such as students saying, it's really nice to go to school once the sun is up, right? Because these are kids who are going to school in the dark and getting home in the dark. They had more energy. Parents are describing their kids are no longer zombies, that they enjoyed talking to them. Kids are eating breakfast. So lots of different changes.
Talking to Lisa Meltzer, a pediatric psychologist, professor at National Jewish Health, looking at school start times and kids' sleep, especially teenagers' sleep. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We heard from Claire on Facebook, who writes, my child attended a private school in Chicago that recognized the biological differences in children at different ages and adjusted the school day start time so that younger children started earlier. My high school classes started later, around 9 a.m. Sounds like Claire appreciated that change. Are you seeing, Lisa, more and more schools, public and private, starting to do what Claire's kids' school did?
Absolutely. So in Colorado, a number of our districts have changed. This year, the Denver Public Schools, our largest district, has implemented these healthy changes. The state of California actually passed a law that the implementation got delayed because of COVID, but finally went into effect, where middle schools are not allowed to start before 8 a.m. and high schools are not allowed to start before 8:30. And that's a statewide mandate. Other states have been following up with similar types of legislation. Florida just recently passed it. And then school districts, as we know, are locally controlled. And so there's a number of districts across the country, large districts and small districts, that have implemented this. And then even more districts that continue to study whether or not this is beneficial, which we know it is.
A common objection, I think, Lisa, is for kids who have after school extracurricular activities, clubs, sports teams, what have you. If the school end time gets later, all of a sudden those things are starting to run into dinner time at home. Is that an objection that you've encountered?
You definitely see some delays there. In our district, one of the things they did was they decided to have shorter practices because the students were well rested. And so if you have shorter practices where the students are more engaged, those are actually more effective than longer practices with sleep deprived athletes or extracurricular, you know, the different activities. In our research, we found that participation did not significantly decline. And another objection parents often put forth is that students need to work after school. And what we found was that students from low income backgrounds, their actual employment didn't change. And in fact, the number of students or percent of students employed went up with the later start time. So it didn't have a negative impact on either activities, athletics, or after school employment.
Our caller earlier, when we were talking to the Madison reporter, mentioned the idea of daylight savings time being part of our problem. I understand that's something you've looked and thought about, Lisa. What do you think?
Yeah, I think that people are tired of switching. They don't want to go back and forth from daylight saving time to not to standard time. But people have this misperception that we need to stay on permanent daylight time because in the summer, our days are long and everybody feels like if we stay on permanent daylight time, our winter days will be long. But the thing is that they won't. Our days get shorter in the winter because that's just the way the earth rotates. We need to be on permanent standard time because that allows for light in the morning and darkness in the evening. And that light in the morning is what tells our brains to stop making melatonin and wake up. And the darkness in the evenings is the cue to our brains to make melatonin and prepare for sleep. So the caller was right. A permanent standard time is actually the most healthy way to approach sleep and wake for everybody, no matter how old.
We heard from Cody on Facebook, who writes, why does the school day not follow normal work hours? Most households don't have a parent at home full time. The tricky thing there, I guess, is what is normal work hours? I don't know if most people even do 9 to 5 anymore. Should the standard work schedule be part of the discussion here, though, Lisa?
I think that, as you pointed out, there is no more standard work schedule. I do think schools need to be cognizant of the variety in work schedules. I think especially at the elementary school level, having activities that students can participate, especially low cost or free activities for working families, so they don't have to pay for before or after care. In our district, we found that before school care basically disappeared once we moved elementary schools from 9 to 8, but the number of students in after school care doubled. So a number of schools came up with activities. They partnered with the Boys and Girl Club or the YMCA to have free and low-cost activities for students to participate in until parents were done working.
Lisa, if there's a parent out there listening whose kids still have that early start time, or a district administrator pondering this, what do you suggest to start the process, to start the conversation, to move a district to bump those start times back?
I think it is a conversation. I think before districts change, they need to engage with the community and find out what the concerns are. Find out things like middle school parents are concerned that their kids won't get on the bus. So can middle schools open for breakfast and study hall so parents can still drop those kids off and get to work on time? I think, you know, there's things that districts can do to engage the community to make sure that this change, which is an important and positive one, also works for the members of the community. I think parents in the interim need to help their students have very consistent sleep-wake schedules. So not letting them stay up really late and sleep in on the weekends, that makes it very difficult then for those students to go to bed early and wake up early on school days. So I think there's immediate things that families can do, and then broader conversations that districts need to be having between the administration and the families to make this successful.
And at the center of this, Lisa, again, is how important sleep is for a teenager's health. In our just last half a minute or so, could you hammer that point home?
Absolutely. When kids get enough sleep, they do better in school. They have better physical and mental health. We know there's very strong ties between sleep and mental health. We know that their overall quality of life improves. We know that when students don't get enough sleep, it's tied to weight gain. It's tied to depression. It's tied to poor physical functioning and social interactions. And so sleep is essential. It is an essential biological feature that everybody needs to be at their best.
Lisa, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Lisa Meltzer is a pediatric psychologist and professor at National Jewish Health. She joined us for a look at why schools around the country are considering later start times, especially at the high school and middle school levels, and how school start times affect student health and educational outcomes. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Now, does your life feel optimized, honed for peak efficiency, personal, work, or kids' schedules carefully arranged for maximum productivity, diets juiced for balanced macros, etc.? If this is you, your life, does it feel like that's working for you? Do you think you're better off being as efficient as possible? Our next guest says that optimization is all around us, and not just at the daily personal level. Companies and organizations have been using optimization for generations, constantly trying to grow upward, outward, and better inward. The results, she says, have been lucrative up to a point, and they've come with lots of downsides. She toured the country, finding examples of the impact of optimization and meeting people who resisted it one way or another. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you see yourself as an optimizer in your work life, your personal life? Have you seen your workplace do some kind of optimization for better or worse? Or have you maybe gone off the grid in some way, picked a slower path, a slower pace of life and work? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Coco Crummy is an applied mathematician and writer based in the Pacific Northwest. She's the founder of a scientific consultancy, and her new book is called Optimal Illusions, The False Promise of Optimization. Coco, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, Rob. Glad to be here.
Now, I want to talk about your origin story a little bit, because your career up to a point would have made you put you at ground zero of optimization as a mathematician in Silicon Valley. Where were you? What turned you away from that?
Well, you know, it goes back even farther still. I grew up in the Bay Area, sort of on the cusp of an earlier tech boom. And then I went east for college and grad school at MIT, which was another center of optimization, and came back to Silicon Valley when it was sort of roaring into the latest tech boom. And, you know, the book is a little bit a story of my own disenchantment with that world and how I made it from there to a remote Pacific Northwest island.
Now, can you explain this concept of optimization? Just set it up for people who haven't thought about it a lot. What do we mean when we say optimization?
Sure. Well, I like to start with a couple definitions. There's the technical one, and then there's the more colloquial one. The technical one is probably familiar to anybody who works in engineering or statistics, mathematics, and even the corporate world. And it's this idea of taking an objective function or something that you want to maximize and a set of constraints or parameters and solving that equation or that set of equations to get to the best outcome possible given your constraints. Now, the more colloquial definition is this idea of optimizing, of controlling the natural world in some way in order to lead a better life or make the best of what you have. And I argue in the book that that mindset has, well, it grew out of technical roots as well as some cultural origins in kind of the founding of our country. It's pervaded our daily lives in these incredible and enormous ways.
Yeah, it's reading your book, you know, I thought, okay, yeah, Silicon Valley or a big business or General Electric, of course, they're trying to optimize. But reading your book, I think about all the ways, all the things we see advertised to us as ways to optimize our diets or maximize the output of our time, even when we're not working. It's almost like an ideology has emerged where optimization is our optimal goal.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think if you spend any time in or around Silicon Valley, right, you see it everywhere from billboards for technical things, optimizing HR or optimizing your servers, to really everyday things, right? You see it on vitamin labels. There is this sort of cult. I mean, you alluded to it being a religion, and I very much think it shares some features with religions or cults, right? But there's this cult in Silicon Valley of eating or drinking these products that allow you to get sort of optimal nutrition with the least amount of time and effort. So you kind of drink your diet and there's no attention to whether it tastes good, whether it's enjoyable, whether you're sharing that meal with people you care about, sort of the traditional reasons we would come together and eat in the first place beyond simply feeding ourselves.
Talking to Coco Crummy about her new book. It's called Optimal Illusions, The False Promise of Optimization. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Coco, you were just hinting at something that I wanted to ask about, and you talk about a lot in the book, is optimization sounds like a rational process, but it starts with deciding what we want to optimize in the first place. And you spend time on North Dakota sugar beet farms a lot in your research for the book and leading up to it. And you raise like, okay, if we want maximum yield, that's going to mean one thing for optimization. If we want maximum profit, that might mean something different. If we want maximum soil preservation, something different still. The list goes on and on. How important is it to figure out what we're trying to optimize in the first place?
Well, I mean, I think that's key. And, you know, at the same time, one of the rejoinders to this argument or to my book that I hear from the tech world especially, right, is that, okay, we can admit that optimization or the fruits of some optimization haven't necessarily been good, right? So if we optimize agriculture simply for yields and forget about soil regeneration, or we forget about the communities that optimized agriculture affects, then, you know, that maybe isn't the best thing, but the solution is simply to change what we're optimizing for. And while I think that can be helpful, certainly in certain cases, there's this larger embedded idea that we should be optimizing in the first place. Mm.
And can you talk about what you see as the harm of the optimization mindset in the first place? Whatever we're optimizing, how do you see it as having steered us wrong?
Yeah, and I'll first caveat all this by saying I'm often accused of being a Luddite. while that may be true in certain aspects, I don't think that optimization is all bad. I think optimization as a technology has created some incredible things, right? We wouldn't have the standard of living and the wealth that we have today in the West were it not for optimization. We wouldn't have the safety of certain engineered systems. We wouldn't have modern medicine and dentistry. The pitfall, I think you asked about the pitfall. I just want to make sure I'm
definitely. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, the pitfall is that we forget other ways of seeing the world, right? You look at a lot of cultures and historically and present day outside of our Western kind of corporate driven culture, and you see very different ways of approaching what one should do or what's right, right? These are often driven by cultural norms or ethics, morals, rather than what is the best or what is going to make the most money or, you know, whatever other variable you're optimizing for. And I think there's a certain richness that's been lost there, along with an increasing fragility that we see in many of our overly optimized systems. They simply break down more frequently than were they not so optimized.
Yeah, one of those one of the things that really struck me was optimizing a system takes out slack in systems. Our ability to react to changes, to difficulties, to changing fundamental situations. Can you talk about our loss of slack as we optimize?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is sort of a trade-off that's been pointed out from a lot of different disciplines. You know, in ecology, you have trade-offs between robustness and strength and fragility, right? or speed rather and fragility. When you think about something as simple as weightlifting or training for athletics, a lot of the building of muscle or of endurance happens not so much in the time of exertion, but in the time of rest, right? When those muscles regenerate and grow. And sleep obviously helps us regenerate. Without sleep or rest, we as organisms start to fail and collapse. And obviously in much larger systems like markets and the electric grid. So I you know, argue in the book that one of the major things that we've lost, or the category of things that we've lost as we optimize, is this, you know, this concept of slack or downtime or rest.
We're talking to applied mathematician and author Coco Crummy about her new book. It's called Optimal Illusions, The False Promise of Optimization. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions for our guest about optimization and its problems? Have you experienced some of these negative impacts in your life of optimization, maybe at your workplace? Have you tried to opt out in some ways? Live off the grid, maybe? We'll talk about that in just a bit. You could join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up a conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with author and applied mathematician Coco Crummy. Her new book is called Optimal Illusions, The False Promise of Optimization. Talk about how we became obsessed with efficiency, economies of scale, and how that obsession has brought a lot of negative impacts to people's lives, and maybe what we can do about it. You could join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your questions for our guest. That's 800-642-1234. Jeff joins us now in Superior. Jeff, hi.
Good afternoon. I'm very philosophical, so I appreciate this discussion because I consider myself a minimalist, because when I lived out west in Pacific Northwest, Seattle, Portland, that area, I lived in group settings where we had more than one income in each living situation. And we would have group meetings discussing how can we optimize this resource or this service. And a lot of us just fell away thinking, you know, people are not a means to an end, but an end in themselves. And we really fell away thinking that it's kind of best to live a minimal lifestyle and do more with less.
Jeff, thanks a lot for the call. Coco, your thoughts on Jeff's thoughts about humanity and optimization?
Yeah, no, I love that. I think it's a feeling that's emerging, or it's becoming more prominent in recent years. Obviously, the pandemic was a shock to a lot of systems. Both large-scale economic systems, as well as I think it led to reflection in a lot of people as to whether the path they were on was one that made sense for them. So what you said certainly resonates.
Jeff, thanks a lot for that call. And that actually is a nice segue, Coco, to a lot of your book is talking to people who in one way or another tried to opt out or push back against optimization in one way or another. Let's go back to sugar beet farmers. One farmer you talked to over the course of years was one amongst a co-op of farmers who said, I'm going to try not to go with genetically modified foods at that point. Economically speaking, easier said than done. Can you talk about the challenges he faced?
Yeah, and this was by no means a total back to the land kind of farming operation. It was a sixth generation farm that utilized a lot of fairly modern technology, and he just the owner just didn't want to do GMO, and that in another era would have been a perfectly acceptable and economically viable decision. The problem is that this industry, as with many sectors of agriculture in the U.S., is that sugar beets is run by these co-ops. It's the supply chains are incredibly vertically integrated, right? The co-ops own the processing facilities. They own, in many cases, the transportation, the railroads, or the parts that get the product to the processing facilities. And if everybody else went GMO, there was no way for one holdout to have his crop processed into sugar. So he tried to find workarounds. I won't ruin the or spoil the end of the story, but it was an arduous path for this particular farmer.
And another path, and you talked to some people, and to an extent you've done it a little bit yourself, is the idea of, okay, I'm going to opt out. I'm going to live on an island, say, in the Pacific Northwest, or in some other way go off the grid. We can't all do that, though, I don't think. Can you talk about that back to the land concept you mentioned as a reaction to optimization?
Yeah, and one of the places I land in the book, right, is that it's pretty much impossible for most of us to opt out. I mean, I'm less on the grid, but I'm certainly not off the grid. there's FedEx where I live, right? It may be a little bit slower, but it still exists. The internet exists. It might also be a little bit slower. And as you point out, it's also a choice that in many ways is a luxury today, right? I am lucky enough that I can do work, that is partially remote. That was the case even before a lot of the accommodations for remote work happened due to the pandemic. And that's certainly not the case for a lot, if not most people. And that said, even with that luxury, right, I am tied in all of these ways. So I think while there's this growing desire to slow down or disconnect in certain ways, I think it's a fantasy to believe that you can opt out completely.
Talking to Coco Crummy about her new book, Optimal Illusions, The False Promise of Optimization. Okay, if we don't like living in a completely optimizing world, but we recognize that we can't completely opt out of optimization, what do you recommend people do? How can we start to change our mindset to maybe pick our battles and where we could slow down and avoid the optimization?
Well, I think the first step is exactly what you said, Rob. It's just realizing and being aware of how some of these forces work, and you know, the technical and cultural forces of optimization. I think for everybody, it looks a little bit different, right? If, you know, some people are perfectly fine living in an optimized and optimizing world. It's thrilling in certain ways. And I certainly wouldn't recommend anything different for people who are content with that. I think for those of us who feel a certain malaise at the speed of things or the pervasiveness of this mindset, it's really about not opting out completely, but returning a little bit to first principles, first principles understanding of how these systems work, right? So I may not be able to buy everything, you know, all my food, all my materials from my local community, but to the extent that I can understand where things come from and make conscious choices about the things that I'm buying from abroad or, you know, that are made outside of my direct reach or using technologies, like I don't understand in minute detail how my computer works. but I've made that choice to accept some of those abstractions and those shortcuts because, you know, it does help me do things that I feel are valuable in the world.
You mentioned from time to time talking to people who might have been your colleagues at MIT or Silicon Valley or wherever about these concepts. I imagine a lot of blank stares. How do you sell this idea of we should worry about optimization to optimization central in the high tech industry world?
Well, you know, I think it's actually gotten a little bit easier since I first conceived of this book, which was in around 2014, 2015 or so, when the tide hadn't yet turned against big tech, right? And we were all still in its enthralled and enchanted, right? We you know, and I'm speaking sort of the collective cultural sentiment was that Twitter and Facebook and Google were, you know, not only these magical innovations that were going to make their founders and shareholders rich, but they were literally going to save the world. They were going to save democracy. They were going to allow creative people to express themselves and find audiences. And I think some of that promise, those promises have perhaps manifested in certain ways, but the tide has really turned, you know, to the point where we see these companies as, you know, as profit-seeking corporations that they are. And so that's certainly helped my argument. I think I get fewer blank stares nowadays. But, you know, that techno-utopian mindset is still very much alive. And I think time and history will tell, right, whether these promises of AI and automation and technology kind of saving ourselves from ourselves and granting infinite leisure time and, you know, infinite resources to everybody and equality, you know, and justice to boot, if that actually manifests or we see a sort of different future for technology.
We'll leave it there. Thanks to our guest, Coco Crummy, talking about her new book, Optimal Illusions, The False Promise of Optimization. Tomorrow on Central Time, as deer season gets ready to start this weekend, there's concern about a declining number of hunters in the state. Find out why and what it means for deer management. That and more tomorrow here on Central Time.